Before we get started with our chat, please give us a little taste of what the cleaner's all about.
Okay, I'm going to read just from the opening.
Brandy, I muted you. I'm sorry. I meant to mute myself. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But my guest today is Brandy Wells. Brandy Wells is the author of the novella This Boring Apocalypse, as well as a full-length chapbook of stories, Please Don't Be Upset. Their fiction appears in Puerto del Sol, Mid-American Review, Tri-Quarterly, and many other journals. A native of Georgia, they teach creative writing at California State University, Fullerton. Their new novel is The Cleaner, an offbeat, darkly clever tale about a night cleaner who discovers a toxic secret about her company's CEO and decides to take matters into her own hands. Welcome, Brandy.
Hi.
I'm so excited to talk to you. We were kind of joking earlier that we've kind of known about each other for many years now, but we haven't actually met, which is so weird because I feel like, I feel like I've been aware of you for so long. So when I got the chance to read this book, I was so excited. I had heard about it before you even got in touch with me. It's exactly the kind of book I want to read. It's super weird and bizarre and surreal and poignant and funny, and I just ate it up. So I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Before we get started with our chat, please give us a little taste of what the cleaner's all about.
Okay, I'm going to read just from the opening. Every day, some rogue shitter leaves a streak of feces on the back of the toilet seat, right where his ass crack would be. He picks a different toilet each time, like we're playing a game of cat and mouse. Sometimes, before I look, I imagine that this time he shuffled forward and missed the seat, or that he's constipated, so there's no shit at all, but it's always there. Imagine seeing that first thing in the morning. Imagine the kind of tone that would set for your day. Trying to write emails and finish presentations and smile in the hallway, but thinking ass crack, ass crack, ass crack. Tonight, I go to the top floor because Elle will check the others first, and in the meantime, I'll have some peace. She spends all night following me around as though without her supervision, I might damage the building or commit petty theft. Like, oops, I meant to clean the floors, but I've accidentally stolen a sensitive file on sweaters and also spray painted lopsided boobs across the lobby wall. But I guess she has nothing else to do, no threat to manage in a building like this. I rest at sad intern's desk. It's stuck in a corner. All the other desks are pushed together in twos or fours with dividers between them to create the facade of privacy, but hers is against the wall, an afterthought. She's been here almost 2 months, and the top of her desk remains neat, but the drawers are full of information. What started as a bottle of probiotics, some B12, and a book on how to master your feelings has completely taken over her desk. There's zit cream and pimple patches and bobby pins full of broken off hair. Almost every day, I clean granola or cracker crumbs out of the top drawer where she's secretly eaten, hunched over, or hiding her food. She doesn't want to leave her desk and miss anything. An intern has to maintain a kind of vigilance, waiting for something important to happen, for her chance to be important too. She lives not just at her desk, but in it. Her top drawer, which ought to be full of paper clips and notepads, is instead full of capsules and powders, all geared towards self-improvement. Get rid of stress, strengthen your hair, increase your sex appeal. That one has a picture of a tiger on the front and includes real animal pheromones. And pushed way in the back are two different kinds of pills, one bottle covered in cartoon flames and the other with the word miracle in large print. I consider leaving them on top of her desk in full view, but she seems so helpless that I can't bring myself to do it. I dig into another drawer and find a tampon, not even in its plastic wrapper or applicator, but loose, and three new books, all about feelings and what to do with them, who's having them, and how to produce the ones you want. She's awfully sad, I think. Sad intern. Her supplements have multiplied over the last few weeks. The sex dust is her newest. It's shimmery, probably in an attempt to make it seem less sad. Young women have been trying to look less depressed by coating themselves in glitter for decades. I'll stop there. Is that okay?
That's perfect. Thank you so much. I'm glad that's where you that's what you read to us from, because it's such a great snapshot of what makes his character so captivating. Is that they're obsessed with seeing, right? With like fully grasping the vibes, you know, and like being very aware of the, you know, like who people are based on, you know, what they're interested in, what they're like, the detritus they leave behind, the things that they hold dear, the things that they hide. And so it's the cleaner is very convinced that she sees things more clearly than anyone can see them, but she doesn't.
Yes.
She's very she first of all, she cannot see herself very well, so that's such an interesting part of her character, is that maybe it's not that she can't, it's that she won't. It feels like at times that she's just not going to think about herself in that way. But she sees in these people sort of this narrative that starts to build and get bigger and bigger and bigger, possibly based on how, you know, she has felt about things, or how she wants someone to feel, so that they need her, so that she feels needed. But she's bad at it. And I just find that so delightful and maddening at times. You know, that she's so devoted to this lifestyle and this I don't know, I imagine like a monk who's obsessed with like beating themselves, you know, to show how pure they are. She reminds me of that. So I don't know, I want to hear from you where she came from. Where did this cleaner come from?
I think above all, she's a storyteller, and I have always been fascinated by storytellers, by characters that are like metafiction, characters that are in something and start to tell a story. Like even as a little kid, I remember being thrilled at, do you remember the Muppet Babies cartoon?
Yes, absolutely.
In the Muppet Babies cartoon, they would start imagining something and then suddenly it would become it would be concrete and real and have like real repercussions and they'd be in it. And of course, I didn't have like the language for what that was, but I knew that was what was for me, right? That was the thing I wanted the most. And I love to see any kind of fiction that has a character building their own world. And I feel like the characters I see doing that are often not people that get to determine, like, that are in positions of power and get to determine what the narrative is, right? It's the people that are subjugated in whatever way. Those are the people that are building their own narratives because they have to, right? And so I've always been thrilled by that position. That's what I want to write and what I want to read.
What an incredible example of like the ways that your mind interprets something that you like viewed or experienced as a child, like how it touches this thing that's more sensitive or open when you're a kid. And it's like, as an adult, you can understand what's happening, right? But as a kid, the line between what's real and what's something that you could imagine or something you could like start to
Yes.
fall into is it's not so defined, right? And so I love, I want a podcast where writers just talk about those things. They're like,
Yes.
this thing happened as a kid, or I saw this thing that happened as a kid and I didn't fully understand it, but I was there, I could you know, like it made so much sense on a cellular level, you know. What a beautiful example. And it reminds me, my husband wants someone to make a cartoon called Seinfeld Babies. It's just
Oh,
the Seinfeld characters as babies, like in Muppet Babies.
I would watch that. That sounds great.
Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't you want to see Elaine, you know, like bossing people around in her preschool?
Absolutely. I'd like to see Elaine and Miss Piggy like together.
Oh my God. I didn't even think that the Muppet Babies would also be there.
Crossover.
Well, so when you were sitting down to write this, did you think this is going to be a novel? Like this person, I'm going to follow this person around for a novel's length of pages? Or was it like, this voice is here, I've got to figure out where it's going? What was it for you?
I definitely did have the plan for it to be a novel, like from the jump. I love the idea of her almost never interacting with any other people, right? So it's just her like building fiction around her. And I wanted to see how long I could sustain that for and like what that looked like. And of course, like one of my favorite moments is like when she interacts with the office workers in real life and gets to see sort of
God.
her fantasy against reality, or readers get to see her fantasy against reality, right? And it's so jarring and upsetting for her and for me to see it happening. But I think that voice, her voice, is probably my really natural sort of thinking voice. I have to admit, whenever I see people talking about not liking her or her being a sociopath, I'm like, oh no, like that's just my natural resting state, if I were really, really honest.
Sociopath at all. She feels very deeply. And
That's what I thought.
yes, I think like the spaces that people inhabit at when and the spaces that are left when they're not in those spaces, they feel charged in a way, or they can feel charged, especially if you're sort of searching the way that she's searching for a purpose, you can use their things to sort of, like we've been saying, start to tell yourself a story that matters and that
Yeah.
you can then be a part of. And so, no, she's not a sociopath. She's incredibly flawed in her thinking,
Sure.
but also very relatable because, my brother and I were obsessed with the model homes in our neighborhood when we were kids. There was like four different types of homes you could buy in this neighborhood, and they had the model homes for them like near the front of the neighborhood, and you could go in them and they were furnished, but like the furniture was like wrong in some way, like some of it was cardboard, or like the TV was just like a piece of plastic screen, like in a box. And so it felt like you were wandering these spaces where someone was trying to approximate humanity, but they didn't quite understand it. And so it felt
Oh my
like
God.
bizarre and uncanny, and like you could sort of write over it this life that you were imagining. And so, like, and it wasn't until this wonderful moment where she marches on down to the office, like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. She's part of them. They know her, that she sees how wrong she was. Yarn guy's the most heartbreaking.
Yes.
Because he's the one who left the note, the terrible bitchy note about, these things that she was doing that she thought she was communicating with him,
Yes.
through. And yeah, and so like she takes all these like to us like small little steps to enact change, because in her world they're huge. But in our world, L at one point is like, so the CEO messed up. Why don't you just tell someone? Just tell someone, like if you think the CEO is doing something, go tell someone. And the cleaner's like, no, you don't understand. I realize I've just been
Yes.
talking to you about your book and not letting you talk
No,
at
you're good. I wanted to tell you that while you were describing the model homes, like you can't see me, but like my mouth was like agape with delight, because I still feel like I would really love to walk through that and be in that kind of weird space. I think, yeah, I've thought a lot about her like inventing these people and why she's inventing them, and I assume, have you read Ling Ma's Severance?
Of course, I love that book.
Yeah, so like she just keeps going to her work because even though an apocalypse is happening, because like there's nothing else like meaningful or important in her life. And I think this book also follows that natural endpoint. If your work is your entire life, if it's everything about you, it's where you get all your happiness and meaning, like what's the natural thing that you would do, right? You would throw yourself into it. You would want everyone else to throw themselves into it. You'd want to like help them, like be the fullest and best versions of themselves if this is the only thing that matters and the only thing that's important. And while I was working on this book, I was in the final year of my PhD, going on the job market, writing my dissertation, and like writing this book at the same time. So it was impossible not to feel like work-like things was all I was, right? It was like everything about me. I like didn't really have much of a social life. I was just only doing those things. So like it was so easy for me to put myself in her frame of mind because I felt like that's what I was doing.
It even transfers to her home, you know, like she has dressed her home
Yes.
up as work with all these things that she's taken.
Yeah, she's making like a little mini office, right? And that's what work does too. You drag it home with you, or I do, right? Like I'm teaching, so I drag my work home for me and it expands to fill whatever space I have if I let it, right? I'm like falling asleep at night and I'm thinking about, oh, this is what I need to do for this class. And oh, why didn't I say that this way? And oh, I need to give feedback to that student, or I need to return this email. Like it comes home with us.
That's one of the most delightful things that I think this book does. You know, it kind of turns on its head this notion of like the kind of work that one would bring home with them, or that one
Yes.
would devote their minds and their lives to. Because you don't think, oh, an office cleaner, you imagine that the office cleaner's done cleaning and is like peeling tires and like can't wait to get out of there, right? And I think that's like a shame that we think of it that way. It's like, oh, well, that's not real work or something, or that's not the kind of work
Yeah.
that requires your whole heart and soul the way that this other work does. When it might very well, right? Like if you value the stuff that you're doing, then it might matter.
I love that you said the phrase real work, because I think I level that, like, is writing real work, right? Like, is that like real work that we could think about as work? I have a kind of migraine called a daily chronic migraine. So I've had a headache since January of 2020 that never goes away. I always have
Oh
a
my
headache.
God, what?
Yeah, I've done a whole laundry list of things. I've gotten Botox and magnesium infusions and like injections in the back of my skull and been on tons of medications. But I think what it comes down to, it's like it's worse with stress. And I think for a long time, I imagined all the work I was doing wasn't work. So it couldn't be stress. It couldn't be related to that, right? So I was like having panic attacks and like having these like headaches that affected my vision, right? With like black splotches. And I still have them, but they're a little more managed now than they used to be. But I was imagining that it couldn't be stress. I was like turning that down. I was like, no, it's definitely not stress. It's something else, because I didn't think any of the work I was doing was real.
You know, that's so apt. And I feel like a lot of people listening have that same, like maybe not even consciously, but have that same impulse to think, well, I'm not building something with my hands, or I'm not, you know, designing the blueprint for a home, and I'm not saving lives, and you
Yeah.
know, I'm pursuing my dream. Ugh, it's not work, but it very much. And I'll tell you why I know that, because only recently have I let like the other parents at my kid's school kind of understand what it is I do because of that impulse where it's kind of like, you know, these are lawyers and they're you know, they're in marketing or they're starting their own businesses. They're all very ambitious, accomplished people. And only recently have I, you know, because I had a book that came out, so it was kind of coming out anyway. People were figuring it out. And when
Sure.
they hear that I'm a writer, they're like, oh, I could never do that. You know, they're like, that sounds terrible. Some people don't like, and we surround ourselves with writers. And so people who love to do this, or who, you know, maybe they don't love it, but it's what they have to do or whatever, you know, but there's a whole world out there that thinks that sounds terrible.
I love that. I've never run into that. I always run into people that are like, oh, I have an idea for a book. I just haven't written
Right.
it yet. I feel
Well, yeah,
like
there's those people, but they're like, and I'll never write it because writing is boring.
I love that.
Isn't
That's
that
so
great?
nice.
Yeah, and so like they have this, they actually do have this deference and respect for what it is I do because it's something that they couldn't imagine, right? It's work. It's work that they do not want to do. And
Yeah.
so I'm telling you, it is work. It is stress. And when you're putting yourself out there, you know, you're not necessarily putting yourself out there when you're I don't know, like setting a broken bone, right? Because you're like
Sure.
you're using the tools that you've learned and whatever. But when you're putting yourself out there, like here's a piece of me that I have honed over years from doing this over and over again through school, through teaching. Here's a piece of
Yeah.
me. What do you think? You know, like there's this partnership. And when
Oh
they
my God.
shit on you or you think about what the possible response is, that's stress, right? Like that's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was just in denial for a long time. I thought I didn't have stress. I thought I didn't have anxiety, which is it's so untrue, right? I have so much anxiety, and I have I have OCD, right? So I have a lot of intrusive thoughts, and I have all these things that I didn't admit to myself that I had. I thought I was so chill and so good at navigating like through life, and I think my body eventually was like, no, you're not.
Oh
Actually,
my
you're
God.
terrible at this. You're doing a terrible job.
Oh.
So it was such a wake-up call. I feel like I would have just kept going, right, the
Of
way I
course.
was,
Of
if my
course.
body hadn't stopped me from doing so. Because again, it didn't feel like real work. It didn't feel like anything that I could possibly have complaints about.
Well, it's like it's funny because if you take that through to its logical end, if you're like, okay, fine. I'll just try this other more real work. You
Yes.
wouldn't be any less stressed, you know?
I have a friend who dropped out of a PhD program in Utah, and she moved back home, and now she's a loan officer at a bank, and like has leapfrogged over promotions and like seems so happy to me. I keep waiting for her to report back that she's
Interesting.
not, but she's like, oh, they really appreciate it when I like pick something up really fast. They like make me feel like I'm doing a good job. And it's just like everything that teaching isn't, right? It's everything, all the recognition and the pay, like she just bought a house. So I don't know.
Ugh.
I think some jobs maybe, but I also don't want to like wake up and go to work at 9 o'clock and come home at 5. Like that sounds bad too.
It's so funny. I was a teller for like a
Ooh.
year, and it really was like that. It really was. It was, you know, like the same hours
Yeah.
and like very rote tasks. And then they started, this was years ago, but they started wanting you to like sell while you were at the window. So like when you were helping someone with their cash, their check, be like, did you know you could get a checking account here and you could get blah, blah, you know, and that sucked because I hate that. But I do have a fondness in my heart for like rote tasks you can kind of mindlessly do and get paid really well to do. That seems
Yeah.
like a dream. But I do think it's just, there would be a moment where just the way your body's communicating with you, something would rise to the surface that I couldn't ignore. Like,
Yeah.
you have to do this other work that matters, right? I mean, that does happen to me from time to time when I don't have time to write. It'll rise up in another way. I'm like, oh, I'm yelling at my family. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I think the thing that makes me the happiest is like starting a new project, right? Like diving into a new novel when like everything feels possible and it's so fun. And the thing that makes me the unhappiest is like revising that novel and getting to the end and putting that novel out. So those things are at odds.
Yeah, there's always like a moment of grief for me when I feel like it's like I've taken it as far as I can go and I send it to my agent because it's like or whatever, like if I submit it somewhere, it's
Sure.
like this was my little thing and now someone's going to have some say about it and that sucks.
Awful.
You know?
Yeah, awful.
Especially then I don't know why revising is so painful for me and why I keep thinking I can outrun it. I can outwrite it, you know, but I
Yeah.
can't. I don't know what that is.
That is, yeah, my headaches are the worst whenever I'm like revising and revising and revising. It's because you're like stuck in the past, right? You're like out of your
Yes.
body, you're in the past, you're somewhere else, and it just feels terrible. I don't know.
You have to reconnect with this thing that you were deeply connected to, and that it's hard to get back into that headspace and also be thinking about other people reading it.
Oh, yeah, that's yeah, the worst.
It's the worst. This is a really stressful job.
It is, but it like doesn't feel like it should be, right? I feel like I have this idea of writer that's different than my lived experience as writer. I don't know. It's the same with teaching though, right? I'm only teaching two classes right now, which sounds so cushy and so easy, and then somehow it's not. Somehow it still expands to fill all of my time. It doesn't matter what I'm doing, I'll let it expand to like fill my time.
I'm only teaching a class and it only meets once a month. And it freaks me out all the time. I like in the day and I'm teaching it tonight and I'll think, why are they even listening to me? Or like, how can I make their time worthwhile? Like, what can I do? What can I be of like, how can I be of utmost use to them? And like, what can I tell them? I will like lay myself bare and try to help them learn and get them. And it's like, I never get to the point where I'm like, okay, I kind of, you know, like I can kind of like believe that it's going to be okay. You know?
That's exactly it. I'm teaching a grad class this semester, and two of my grad students bought the book and brought it to class for me to
Oh.
sign. And I thought, that's so sweet, but like also, oh no, like you shouldn't read this while you're in my class, because if you read it and you don't like it, then you're stuck with me as your teacher all semester. That seems awful. You should
That
definitely read it when you're done with me, so that way if you don't like it, it doesn't affect our classroom space.
you
I
know,
don't
I
know.
think for a lot of them, it's like this book was published. I don't care if it's good or not. This book was published, and that's what I want, you know? So this person kind of knows something that I can learn, you know? Like I had to like vet, you know, the manuscripts of the people that wanted to take this class with me and kind of decide on my cohort. And
Oh, wow.
I had assumed, oh, okay, they must be familiar with my work. That's why they're applying. That's why they want to
Yeah.
work with me. And like half of them don't have any idea who I am. I mean, you know, like half of them are, you know, kind of like, oh, you had a book that just, you know, like, which is so actually great, you know, like they were just
Yeah.
looking for an opportunity to work on their stuff, you know, have a community, learn from someone who has been vetted by this organization, you know, that's putting on me.
Sure.
But I'm like, I was shocked by that. I was like, oh, okay. Which is kind of nice. It's kind of like, okay, they don't know like that I'm not like a traditional, you know, like I'm not like a, I don't know. I don't know. I tell myself these things that like make it all feel better, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. That makes sense to me.
But what about, what about teaching do you think is like so, because it sounds like it really like, I'm making an assumption here that it's like part of what you love about the writing life.
I think it's This feels like so off brand for me because I wrote this book that's about work and it's sort of anti-work and anti-capitalist, but I love my job in a way that's like stunning. I'm sure there are things I could complain about, but I think it's really fun to pick apart the process and to like talk to students about it and have them doing like in-class writing activities and sharing. I find it so generative, right? Like we read Dear Mothman, which is this incredible book about grief and about like this transgender kid who is like grieving the loss of his best friend who's also transgender, and they only knew about each other. Like they're not like sort of out publicly. So it's like grief over identity, grief over
Oh my
loss.
God.
And it's so beautiful. It's like written mostly in letters to Mothman because they like really believed in Mothman. And it's so fun to watch the students pick it apart and then try to like mirror the formatting of it and think about like what fiction can be and how it can be shaped, because it's a novel in verse, right? So it's like all poems. I didn't know this when I assigned it. I like listened to the audiobook and I was like, this is a novel and I like it. My kids are gonna read it. And then I got the hard copy and it's all poems. And I'm like, wow, we're still gonna read it, but we're gonna have like a cool conversation about it. But I think there's something so exciting about them discovering things. It reminds me of how exciting it is to figure these things out and for these things to feel new and interesting. And I teach at CSU Fullerton, which has a student body who are largely first generation college students. Some of them are community college transfers. And I just feel like I am looking at versions of me. Right, because I came up through academia. I did an MFA and a PhD, and most of my classmates were like from pretty extreme privilege, right? Like their parents had money, like things were comfortable and easy for them. And that was not my experience. Neither of my parents graduated high school. So like talking to these kids that feel like I would have fit in with them. I would have been comfortable with them, and like looking at the way they pick up academia and writing and the way nothing is a given is really thrilling. I don't know. I feel like that was not a very articulate answer.
Oh no, that was beautiful. Do you find yourself, you know, kind of having these conversations or thinking about your class or whatever, and like seeing how it's like feeding your own writing, you know, like are there moments where you're like, oh my God, you know, like there's something happening here. I'm gonna go write about it.
I think one of the big things for me is I love to talk to them about voice, and we do all these activities where they're like trying out different voices, right? And like the idea that you have one voice is something we're getting away from, right? You have lots of different voices, and here are all the different voices you have. And having them do this sort of like play acting and improv on the page, like I think the big thing is like, oh, I want to go home and do that too. That is so fun. I want to do the fun thing that my students are doing. And I'm often like circulating the room and talking, and I'm not like doing the activity with them, but like I go home and I want to do the activity too. I want to write too. And it feels nice to be around a bunch of people that are excited about it, where everything, again, the same way when you start a new project and everything feels possible, everything feels possible to them. I remember people crushing my dreams really early. They're like, it's really hard to publish a book. It's really hard to publish a story. It's really hard to get into grad school, hard to get a job. And it was just all doom and gloom. And I think they were trying to be realistic, so I didn't have unrealistic expectations, but it like was so crushing. And there's no reason not to like feel like things are possible. And so I love that space of things being possible.
Do you find yourself like riding the line between dream crushing and also like expectation setting? Or do you just kind of say it's wide open?
I do want to do expectation setting. I had a student who wanted to, their like sort of project they were doing, they were like, I want to publish a novel and it's like a couple years away. And I'm like, I think that that is an unrealistic goal. I think your goal could be you want to write a novel, right? And like you could write it and we could revise it and talk about it. But sort of your final seminar project shouldn't be publishing a novel. Like that timeline feels bad, right? Like, who knows what kind of time or space you're going to need or want, and then what kind of publishing track you're going to be interested in when you get to the end of writing it. I think you should leave yourself space for possibility. So I do want to be realistic, but I guess I would rather err a little bit on the side of like not crushing their dreams, just because I feel like it was so, everything about school felt so crushing to me.
I do think, like, first of all, I love how you phrase that because it focuses on the work that they're going to do rather than this outside thing, right? Like to me, and this is what I tell my students, is what I tell my son when he asks me if he's going to be in the NFL one day, is the good news is it's just work and you know how to work, you know? And so it's like, and you know how to make, you know how to work toward this thing that you are building. So focusing on it that way rather than, and I want to get published, or I want to win this award, or whatever. It's like focusing on the work is always the answer for me when I start to get in the weeds, or kind of bewildered, or feel disconnected to what connected me to everything in the first place, right? Is the work. It's the work, the work, the work. And that's the good news, because it's just hard work. We can all do that, you know? Like we can all work as hard as we're possibly able to do at any given moment. I
We
know
sure can.
that doesn't sound like good news, but like it's like relying on the skills that you have, you know, like the things you can do.
Yeah, I think at the forefront of it too, you can't be thinking about like the measurable outcome and judgment, right? Like you can't start a novel thinking about like how hard is it going to be to publish this, or you know, maybe some people can, good for them. I can't. I started this PhD program years ago with the idea that I'm probably never going to get a job, and like I guess I wish I hadn't spent so much time thinking that, because it actually wasn't as grim as I thought it would be, right? Like I went on the job market and I did get a job. I had lots of interviews. It was fine, right? Like, but I spent all this time thinking that possibilities were really grim. I was going to be jobless. I was going to be destitute. And I don't know. I like put the work in and it was possible. I don't know.
There you go, the work.
Yes. Yeah,
That
it was the work.
And maybe like
Oof.
expecting the worst, you know, was like, oh, this is, rather than like ex it's expecting, you know, the best or something easier than the actual work that went into it would have been harder in some way. I don't know.
Yeah, you're probably right. I did like break my back like trying to do all the things, right? And trying to make myself hireable. So it's not like I rested on my laurels. I'd
Right.
like to do
Yeah.
some laurel resting now, though. That sounds nice.
When does that come around? I'd like to
I
know.
don't know. I'm waiting for it eventually, you know, and then my real life starts and it's all restful
That's right.
then.
When is my retire my husband keeps talking about, he keeps sending me homes that we're going to retire in, and I'm like, we're in our 40s, man. Like we're far away from retiring, but it's like he's ready for the laurels resting.
That sounds great. Yeah, I part of each of my checks goes into like a pension, right, for retirement.
Yes.
And I'm almost 40, and I just started this job. I'm not gonna retire, right? Like, I'm starting this late. I'm gonna die in this job. I'd rather them just give me my money. There's not gonna be any retirement for me.
I think that's true for, I feel like that's
So
like a,
many.
yes,
Yeah.
I wish retirement was, going to be on the table for a lot of us, but I feel like it's not actually not going
Yeah,
to be on the table.
not a real thing. Just give me all my money and let me
Yes.
spend it on little lattes and treats every day like I
That's
want
right.
to.
That's right. Exactly. Treat yourself now. Don't wait for later.
Yes.
Well, what was the revising process like for the cleaner? Like, was it much different than your first drafts, or was it sort of honing?
I think it was a lot of honing. Because of my migraines and the way they affect my vision, I use a text-to-voice reader. I use two different ones, one for my phone and one on my computer. And so instead of doing the thing where I print the book out and mark it up a bunch, which I feel like is the thing a lot of people do, I had it read aloud to me over and over again in different voices so I could like spot things. I have one voice that's like very natural and sounds sort of human. And then I have a really robotic voice that like is very unforgiving. So if there's something awkward or bad or a mistake or like something's a little stilted, you can't hide it. It's like very evident. So I must have listened to the book hundreds of times being read to me in different fashions. So I feel like I did a lot of that. I trimmed a lot of people. There were way more employees. I would have enjoyed a book that was just endless, like her inventing people and interacting with them. But at a certain point, like the book needed a bit of a narrative arc and like a start and end, and I couldn't do as much of that as I wanted to.
I love that it starts with the shit on the toilet seat,
Yes.
because people do that kind of stuff. Like people,
Yes.
the ways in which they're not aware of the residue that they're leaving behind, literally leaving behind,
So
is so
wild.
like it's so relatable. And like I remember working in an office where someone like came up with a limerick about, like, if you took a shit in the toilet and it let, and like you flushed or whatever, but it left those shit streaks in the toilet, that's why there was the toilet brush. I don't remember how the limerick went, but it was like a delightful little rhyme talking about how you should use the toilet brush to scrub away here. And it's like, that's kind of like so intimate.
Yes.
Such an intimate, like, not only thing to witness, but also thing to like call out, and ask people to change, like it's, and it feels like work is such this strange place where we're incredibly intimate, incredibly close, but there's walls, like holding us back from like showing our true selves.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I worked with a woman who was really convinced that I was responsible for some sort of like trickling urine on the toilet seat, and I was not. But she was very convinced it was me for some reason. I don't know why she like eyeballed me, and she would like say weird things about it in front of people, and like I didn't know what to do with her. I think about her from time to time. I
She
like
said
wonder.
things about it in front of other people.
Yes, she was so convinced it was me. I have no idea why she thought it was me.
It
But
was
yeah,
her, and she just wanted people to think it was you.
oh my God, I didn't even think of that, but you're probably right. I corrected her spelling one time, and I think ever since I corrected her spelling, she like hated me. She like spelled the name Michael wrong, and I was just like, oh, you need to switch the A and the E there, no worries. And after that, she just hated me. That's my
That is
bad.
wild. I mean, like these freaks are out there, and like, and she didn't think she was acting over the top, right? Like
No.
she was just like in her own little like cleaner type head, like
Yeah, she's just bullying me, right? Adult bullying is so weird, but yeah, she was. Yeah. I hope she's well. I hope her life is going okay.
wouldn't it be ironic if she married someone named Michael?
I would love that. She was already married, so like I
Oh,
don't think she did. But yeah, I would love that. Or like had one of her children and named them Michael. I
And it
think that'd
was
be really cool.
EAL instead of AEL.
Yes. I learned a lesson. Don't correct anyone's spelling. I thought I was being helpful. Like I didn't want her to. I thought we were friends, and I was giving her helpful information, but that was not the case.
She was like, first Brandy pees all over the seat, and now they are correcting my spelling. Hell no.
Yes. Yeah. So like, yeah. I've had a lot of bad coworkers, but she was one of the worst. And it was in rural Georgia too, right? So like there's this like way people are nice but mean, a very like bless your heart kind of like demeanor.
What part of Georgia are you from?
I'm from Southeast Georgia. It's Vidalia, Georgia,
Oh, okay.
home of the sweet onion.
Yep.
And I can't mention my hometown without also telling you about my hometown's mascot, which is Yum Yum the Onion. It's a giant onion who looks very creepy. In your free time, you should Google Yum Yum the Onion because he's terrifying. I had bad dreams about him as a kid. It's like a whole onesie kind of outfit, right? Like he's like you're in the costume, you can't even see that it's a person. It's an onion with legs and a smile.
And would they just show up at like different town events or something?
Yeah, we had an onion festival, an onion street
Oh.
dance, an onion carnival, onion like arts and crafts festival, onion air show. We had to write a Yum Yum story when I
Oh
was like maybe
no.
in late elementary school. Like if someone won the Yum Yum story, it was not me. I did not win the Yum Yum story. I think I was forever killing Yum Yum in
I
the
was gonna say you
story.
probably killed Yum Yum
Yeah,
off.
yeah, yeah. I absolutely killed him. As one should. But yeah, he was around. I had friends later when I was in high school who like wore the costume, right? And it's like never been washed before. It's like disgusting.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I was from a really small town. Like I graduated with like 100 people. It's like really small.
I can remember because I'm from Central Florida, and I can remember driving up through
Ooh.
Georgia to North Carolina where my grandparents lived. And I remember seeing signs for Vidalia. And
Yeah.
my mom at one point had made a Vidalia out onion cake and like eaten half of it. She must have been like pregnant with my brother or
Gross.
something like
What
that.
is in an onion
I
cake?
couldn't because it's a sweet onion, right? And so she's adventurous. It sounds so, and also like the burps that would happen afterward just like horrify me, like the sickly sweet oniony burps. She made herself sick. I don't know what it was. I think she was pregnant with my brother or something, and she was like, I'm gonna make this cake that she saw a recipe for, back in the 80s when there was like gross food
Yeah.
everywhere.
Ugh.
And and she made that cake and made herself sick.
I want to see pictures of an onion cake. I want to see the recipe. I'm going to Google this later. I
I'm
am.
going to ask her about it because I haven't talked to her about it in a long time, and it is quite bizarre.
Please. I wouldn't eat onions as a kid. I only like in my like mid to late 20s when I start eating onions again. They were everywhere. It was gross. I'm not team onion, but I'm okay with an onion now.
I couldn't do onions when I was a kid either, but I love them now. I don't think I can't recall a time that I've eaten a sweet onion though. I go for the red or the yellow or the white onion, not the Vidalia sweet onions.
I think a yellow onion is like really similar. I think
Okay.
a Vidalia sweet onion is a yellow onion. It's just but like a brand name, right? The same way like we have an MV apple or a Braeburn apple. It's just like a brand
You just kind of
of.
blew my mind.
Yeah, it's just a kind of onion. There are also no onions grown in Vidalia. They're like all in the
What?
surrounding counties. It's just like that was the name that had the best marketing. Like the Montgomery County onion doesn't have a good ring to it. The Baxley onion, right? Like so Vidalia sweet onion, it was just like the name that made the most sense.
I mean, it sounds the most southern, Vidalia, like
Yes. Yes.
Vidalia. It's beautiful. It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, I'm trying to get away from that southern accent all the time. But every now and then someone will point it out to me in a way that like reminds me that I do still have an accent.
You don't have a, I had a boyfriend when I was younger who was from Barnesville, Georgia, and he had a deep, deep Georgia accent.
My family doesn't think I have an accent at all.
Oh, of
They
course
think
not.
I talk fast.
You talk Yankee now.
I sure do. My brother really earnestly says, get her done. I can't even do it. He
Get her
like,
done.
yes, he says it like that. I couldn't even do it. But he says that, and he like drops letters off of his words in a way where like it's actually a little hard to tell what he's saying. I don't know. It's a thing. I don't remember him having a southern accent when we were kids, though, right? Like, but now to me, he has a very thick, my whole family has a very thick southern accent.
Wow. And they must think you're highfalutin with your
Yes, I do
rounded
think
vowels.
they probably do think I'm highfalutin. I have less. I talked to a friend actually that I got my MFA in Alabama, and I talked to her on the phone recently, and she's from Georgia, and she said, "Oh wow, you don't have a southern accent at all anymore." And I was
Oh.
thinking, "Oh wow, you sound like Paula Deen to me. You have a really strong southern accent." And it's because I have not lived in the South for a decade, and she's been there forever.
Recently, I've heard myself like saying certain things that sound Midwestern to me, like snack or something, you know, like and I feel like it started as a joke and now it's actually just happening. Like when there was the fear of your face getting frozen, you know, like if you got hit on the back or something. Like I feel like I started joking about the Midwestern accent and now it's just kind
Are
of
you in the
creeping in.
Midwest?
Yeah,
Where are you?
I'm in Chicago.
Oh, I lived in Normal, Illinois for a year.
Oh my gosh, why?
I did a year of the PhD program there, and it was not
Oh.
for me for all the reasons. So I really happily relocated to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But it was so cold. I wasn't prepared. I went outside with damp hair and touched my hair and it broke off.
Yes. Oh my God. I tell this story all the time and I don't think I can tell it accurately, but and I think I tried to write it into my book where I was standing on the corner and the wind ripped snot out of my nose and then whipped it across my face and froze it there.
I cried because I was so cold outside and my tears froze on my face.
Oh
So I
no.
totally can imagine the snot thing. That's grosser, but I can imagine it so well. I
Yeah.
bought a ski mask so I could walk from my car to the building that I taught in so
Oh
that
my
my face wouldn't be
gosh.
so cold. I would also stop at, I think it's Kroger. I would stop at Kroger and I would buy a really large muffin with streusels on it, and I would eat the muffin while I was walking as like a distraction. So I had like a
Yes.
giant treat muffin from my walk from my car
Yep.
to the building.
All of that makes sense. Although today, February 27th, it is 71 outside in Chicago. So it's
Stunning.
very, very strange. My kids are
So
in
stunning.
shorts. Yeah, it's
That's crazy.
I just wanted to ask you, there's all these little hints all throughout the cleaner to the cleaner's real life.
Yes.
Like Jay, I believe it's Jay, right? Is her
Yes.
ex-boyfriend and the job she had before this. And all those kinds of things that like you only give us a little taste. And so I'm doing what the cleaner does. I'm taking those clues and I'm building a story about the cleaner based on those clues. And so I could be getting it completely wrong. And that's kind of a delight in the book too, where you realize like, oh, I'm also trying to like construct this identity for the cleaner that might be completely off base. Because I could get really dark with it, or I could get like, oh, it's just like a normal thing that happens, but the cleaners like takes things a little bit harder than other people, to the point where Yarn Guy mentions the smell in the stairwell when she comes to the office. And I thought, oh my God, something did die in the stairwell and she knows what it is. And she like, I was like going on these dark tangents thinking about, because that's all that we have, right? Is these little clues where we can kind of like build whatever story
Yes.
we want out of them.
I love that. I love that you did that and that you like paid attention to that. I do think you could really easily construct her life out of what's there if you're willing to like be a little imaginative like she is. I didn't want to give so much backstory that her like life looked really full and complete though, right? Because I wanted her job to be her life and I wanted it to feel like she didn't exist outside of the job, but that maybe she used to, right? That this is like a decision she made. This is a thing she threw herself into. And so that other things were possible for her. And that maybe after, like off the page, after the book, other things are possible for her too.
Yeah, because there's just this like beautiful relationship that's starting to happen with M, who's the delivery
Yes.
person. And so there's hope via M all throughout the book. And the way that M treats her is so beautiful too, because like M is very gentle with her, is very like making eye contact, you know, and asking gently if she's okay and listening to her endless, you know, list of reasons why there's something wrong at the office, and like never being like, okay, I got to get away from this person, right? Like M sees something in her, something worthy and tender and precious. And so because of that, because M is trustworthy for me, the reader, I can see that too, which is such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it was really nice to write that character, to write a character that sees somebody else and treats another person like a human being, which I feel like almost feels like fabulism, right? Like to be seen and known and treated with kindness is just, I don't know, a nice warm moment.
It is. And I think also, like, I saw a meme that was too real where it was like, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you were saying, because I was the whole time I was waiting for what when I could speak. And I feel like
Oh my God.
that is such a real way of how we converse with each other these days, you know, like our attention spans and the and like our brains are just firing because of the way that we receive information now. And to encounter a character like M who is so patient and who is just gonna listen, and it's not gonna cost anything. M is not sitting there waiting to tell their story, to break in and have their moment. M is just there to have a conversation. Like it feels so precious and rare, like you're saying.
That makes so much sense. I think waiting for my turn to talk is often my mode in conversations. And it's also because I'm so anxious about like contributing enough or contributing the right thing that like I'm overthinking it. But I feel called out by that.
Oh, I felt extremely called out by that. I get so excited talking to people. I mean, like, this is something I'm trying to get better at through this and through other things, but I get so excited, and I, you know, like I want the interaction to go well that like my brain runs ahead of itself. And then later when I'm going back over the encounter, I'm like, I sounded like a maniac, you know, or like, you know, it's just being able to be fully present and not be thinking, what is this person thinking of me right now? You know, and what can I say to be that will be the right thing, you know, like that kind of grace that we could lend ourselves would be great.
Yeah, I'm going to be thinking after this conversation, thinking about all the times I interrupted you or started to talk over you. It's going to haunt me. I'm going to be like, Lindsay Hunter's never going to be my best friend now.
We're definitely best friends, and you had to interrupt me because I never shut up.
No, you're lovely. I think something happened. I used to talk on the phone all the time as a kid. I grew up in like talking on the phone was like recreation. And now if I'm not talking to someone face to face, if I'm on the phone or I'm on my computer, I have this horrible time finding the right place to talk. I feel like I'm always interrupting.
It is. It's like the rhythms of conversation have changed. Because when I talk to my brother, who is not on social media, like doesn't care about the internet, like has a flip phone if he even knows where his phone is, you know, like
I
he's
love
just,
that.
and so he's a very different type of person to talk to. And I'll think he's done with his sentence, and so I'll break in, but he's not done. And it's because my brain's going too fast and my mouth is going too fast, and he's used to the times before. I really believe that, where it was like everyone had their turn, you know?
That's amazing.
I
I
know.
hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, I feel like you're right. Social media and the internet and all those things did something to the pace of conversation.
Yeah,
God.
I think that's why, like, and even when I'm listening back as I'm editing these episodes, I'll hear myself and I'll think I said something, but I'll have stopped in the middle of a sentence, and the rest of it happened in my head, or it already happened. And I think that's why I feel so much more comfortable, especially these days, like writing things out, because that's when I
Yes.
can get it all out, right?
I'd so much better, like, if I could write it out. I'm the worst, like, oral storyteller. If I'm, like, at a gathering or a party and I'm trying to tell it, I'm using story. I think happens where I can see people zoning out or
Oh
like I
my
can see
God.
someone try to like sideways rock away from me to get out of the
Oh.
conversation and I'm like, Oh no. And you're like, do I just stop talking? I have a friend that does this. If she like is telling a story and she decides it's not interesting or decides she doesn't have attention or whatever it is, she'll just hard stop and refuse to go on. And it's like, I love that about her. I think it's magical. I think she probably comes across as off-putting, but I find it incredibly intoxicating. I'm like, yes, I'm so on board with this hard move that you're making.
Yeah, because why keep going if you don't have, like, people should give the attention, right? Give the grace of your attention.
I do. I feel like I am always thinking about whether someone feels listened to, or like if I see someone else get interrupted, I always want to like say something like, please finish your story, or I'm listening, and I like feel aggravated at all the other people. But I don't think other people are managing the room and thinking about everyone else's happiness and well-being in that way. I think this is, as I'm told, maybe sort of a trauma response where I feel like I'm responsible for everyone's feelings
Oh my God,
all the
yes.
time.
Yeah, yep.
I'm only realizing now, at my like ripe age of 39, that like this isn't how everyone lives every moment of their day. But for me, I'm like, oh, if we're all gathering, I'm thinking, are there enough chairs? Are the chairs arranged comfortably? Do I need to get up and get a chair for someone? But other people aren't doing all this tiny little minutia where they're worried about everyone's comfort and happiness, and does so and so feel slighted? Like, what a nice way to live.
It's a nice way to live, to be on the receiving end of that, to be, to sort of have that, like, that graciousness and that, the time and the listening. But I can totally see what you're saying about it being a trauma response because, like if you had, and I'm not saying this is your childhood, but for example, if you had a difficult childhood and the way to get through it was to make sure everything in your control could be as smooth as possible, or
Yes.
if you only got attention if because you were so different than your siblings or something, because you were so great at making people comfortable or noticing those things. I'm not naming any names, but there might be two people that are talking to each other right now had those kinds of childhoods. Then it would make sense. And but then what happens there is you're not thinking about your own comfort, and it's
Oh,
really
God.
hard to think about that.
No, I will always take the least worst, most uncomfortable thing if a complete stranger can be slightly happier. Yeah, that's
Right,
absolutely
absolutely.
true.
Yeah.
I'll always be at fault. I'll always be to blame. I will take responsibility for something that I know isn't my fault immediately without thinking about it.
It's just wild how those things happen. I mean, like if I'm around a parent, like mainly a male parent, and they're getting frustrated with their kid, I have to get away. Like if like and even if it's just like your run of the mill, like, come on, we gotta go. We gotta go right now. I start to get like, like just, and
Yes.
it's just funny. I mean, I love the male father figure in my life, but it's like, it's just, I don't
I
know.
feel you. I hear you. I have a question for you. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Because I love your novel so much,
Thank
High
you.
Springs Drive, I've read a lot of interviews, and I haven't found you talking about this explicitly. So if you have already, please forgive me. It is so propulsive, even though it's from all these different people's points of view. And I feel like often when things are from different points of view, there's like a slowdown that happens where you get used to the other point of view, and that never happens. It moves so fast. So I just want to hear how you wrote it. Did you like write it in chronological order? Did you have to go back in and like put some of these pieces? How did that happen?
Thank you so much. That makes me so happy that it was propulsive like that.
So fast.
I wanted that. No, I didn't write it chronologically. In fact, I wrote it completely non-chronologically. I wanted it to be kind of scattered everywhere, the way that like it felt like when something like this happens, the story scatters, and like when you're thinking about it, if you're in the family or part of the victim's family or part of the community, you're telling this part of the story, but then you have to go back and tell this other part of the story first, and then you can get back to what
Yeah.
happened. And so that's what I wanted. I wanted to show like the scattered bits of this story and how they affected like everyone possible that I could think of. And then when I was reading it back during revising, I realized it wasn't doing like that was kind of too bewildering. That was not giving like any sort of like lending hand to the reader or any like it wasn't it didn't feel like the kind of story that I was trying to tell. So then I did have to take those pieces and put them chronologically, place them chronologically, and kind of just rely on the fact that there was this terrible violent thing that happened, and the reasons why it happened were what I was trying to write about, but the fact that it happened and how it happened also mattered. And so that's how it sort of like took the shape that it took. And I think also just coming from flash fiction and like really honing that skill over a lot of years and like using that type of process to write the three novels that I've written, I think that kind of makes it feel fast as well. And I like short novels. I just love short novels. Like
Me
I
too.
think they can be really impactful. That's not a word, but they can really, have a big kapow, I guess.
Like Hallie Butler's two
Oh my
novels.
God. Yes. And she has a new one coming
So
out.
I'm so thrilled. I am like counting the days. I'll be like on NetGalley asking for an early version for sure.
Hell
Like
yes.
I just want to read it so much.
She's a genius.
Oh my God, one other thing about your book, if I can.
Sure.
I'm like trying to have restraint here, but I feel like it was like one of my books of the year, right?
Oh
Like it
my
was
God,
just
thank you.
so stunning. I like wanted to shout about it from the rooftops, but the sex in it is perfect. It's so gross and unappealing and like realistic. I was like, this is like the best like gross sex I have read. And I guess I want to ask about that. Is that that's like a gross
Yeah.
question.
No, it's
I'm
not
like
gross at all.
writing those scenes and like,
I love reading sex scenes and I love writing them. I love it. And I think like when I first started having sex as a human being and understanding that like it was a completely different experience than like I knew it could be, like it's every sort of communication you can imagine happens in sex and in sexual touch and intimacy. And you can have like these wordless ways of communicating with your readers or with characters to communicate with each other via sex. And I think also it can show like, especially in the kind of book that I was writing, it can show like the depths of desperation and desire and need. And just like at a certain point, it's just body slapping against body. And so that was a really important part of it because that's everything, right? Like that is the reason why everything happened. It's Jackie desperately needing to be, seen and to like reclaim herself in this way. And sometimes that looks like desire, that looks like, infidelity, that looks like whatever. And then, like that kind of passion and how it can like change your thinking and change your decision-making skills and make you forget like certain truths in your life and kind of like reduce you down to like your base animal need, right? And I don't know, I like to write them. I like to make them sexy. I like to make them gross. I like, I just think that anything you need in a scene, you can get using sex. I mean, it could be like, oh, I want to show these people who are so dead inside. And what would two people who are completely dead inside look like having sex?
Ooh.
Like that would be a fun exercise, a
Yes.
sexercise. Yeah. So I don't know. I love it. I want to write more of it. I love to read it. I wish there was more sex in books recently. But yeah.
I love like kind of disgusting sex like in books by women, right? Like there's Melissa Broder's The Pisces, where they have like
Incredible anal sex, or they try to have anal sex.
the menstrual blood scene too, right?
Oh, yes.
Like that for me was so gross and amazing. Like that book
Yes.
is amazing. Lisa Locascio's Open Me has some really like gross sex things in it. I think it's amazing. If you've ever read that book, I bet you would like it.
I haven't, but I love her.
She's amazing. The book's amazing. But I love that kind of thing. I can't write it very well. I've been trying with the new thing I'm working on to write these sort of like sex scenes, and it all sounds like awkward and childlike. I
Maybe that's
don't
good. Maybe that's good,
Maybe. It's like definitely really uncomfortable. It's like not sexy at all. And maybe that's okay, right? Maybe I'm gonna lean into that, but I think it says something about me. I don't know.
I know people look at me and go, okay, freak, like what kind of sex are, like that people just do, and they think anything that a woman writes is true, and so like I have to fight that off all the time, but
Yes.
like what are you gonna do? Like I'm a writer, okay? I'm a writer. I have a body,
I hear you.
that's all there is to it. Well, this has been such a delight. I loved the cleaner. I think everyone will love it. It just came out last month, right?
Yeah, it came out at the end, almost a month now, the end of January.
Oh my God. Okay, so it's out there, people. Go get it. It is such a like a weirdo, wonderful, so fun and dark and light and wonderful book. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. It was so lovely to talk to you.